Good day, all. My thesis today will be on how social justice art and literature harms actual social justice. Criticizing social justice-tinted issues is a huge taboo in today's discursive climate, especially on the eagerly offended campus and in the cultishly polarized United States. People often retreat to lethargic Moulton Bailey arguments at the first sight of dissent, even if the dissent doesn't say that there's anything wrong with social justice itself. If you criticize a proclaimed activist for their fetishizing of social justice for their own gain, or in getting some of the facts wrong, they may trap you morally and say that you don't subscribe to social justice and make you out to be morally abject. There are nuanced discussions that therefore rarely see the light of day as people are held morally hostage and avoid confrontation. Awful ideas are allowed to live as a result and do damage in the name of agreeable causes. Granted, there are similarly absent-minded on the conservative side that resort to lethargy to criticize social justice issues, i.e. seeing the mere presence of a minority in a film as a sign of cultural Bolshevism and the woke mind virus, but not everyone who disagrees with the hegemony can be conveniently reduced to such idiots so to have a preferred tomato can enemy. People not accustomed to disagreement or mere play with ideas means heightened sensitivity to anything slightly different. What registers as offense is a lot lower, even at this university. Anything other than obsequious and servile repetition of the preferred opinions, youth side-eye glances, and accusations that you're on the polar opposite camp. So I've decided to structure my talk in a way that works around this issue. The first half of today's talk will be a survey of our artistic landscape. I will show you the pervasiveness of social justice attitudes in the arts. I'll dismantle the frequent Moulton Bailey arguments against criticism of social justice art and literature. Inevitably, is this such a bad thing? What's wrong with caring for the marginalized, etc.? The lethargic rhetorical devices that need to be disarmed first before we get to the second half of the talk, which will be a lecture on how social justice attitudes developed out of higher intellectual spaces and academic art theory. I've learned in my experience of giving similar talks that these strawman devices will sprout automatically, and if left to fester, people preemptively in disagreement will cease to listen throughout and even ask confrontational non-questions in the end that were already rebuked earlier had they been listening. Even if none of you need to have their toys taken away, we all have to deal with these manipulative rhetorical devices. I'd like to arm you with the lesser heard arguments to fight out of potential boxes yourselves. This move from mass culture to high culture attempts to warm us up to some of the difficult academic jargon that social justice originates from. The jargon in postmodern and critical theory can often seem so impenetrable that the lay people feel deterred from challenging it. That because they don't understand it, it surely means something intelligent. By taking its fear factor away, we shall see the bogus logic at play here too, so to make more informed beliefs. Finally, I shall conclude with potential solutions for what to do about this landscape. We're all artists here, if not cultural contributors on some level. This affects all of us. This is our outline for today, and now, before we get started, a quick introduction to who I am. My name is Sampi, I'm a British fine artist and media scholar. I've had international art shows and given public talks on art issues. I'm an older senior student here at SCAD, and I'm about to move to NYU for my master's in media studies. I have also been a labour voter my whole life in the UK. As someone who's spent a period of time homeless and living out of council houses in Manchester, working class issues have always been important to me. It's a fallacy to say that I need to have been impoverished to speak on such issues, but it helps in many people's eyes, dubiously. I'm also rather left-leaning on most issues, but think poor grasp of political science and logically fallacious thinking do more damage to good causes. Many people think that because they stand on the correct side, that their logic is allowed to be fallacious, but it often means that their results are horrible when they don't have opinion setters telling them how to think. I'd like us all to get our working out right, even if the results aren't perfect. None of us are perfect. We make better advocates if we acknowledge our own shortcomings, self-correct, and debate in good faith instead of relying on cheap tactics. Others will be more inclined to listen too. So in that spirit, it's always helpful to delineate what we mean when we use certain words before any contentious discussion to avoid semantic issues. Even though it might be obvious, let's dissect what we mean when we say social justice in art. By surveying the existing arts landscape and its discourses, there are some general attitudes that are pervasive in the arts and cultural discussions today that I'd like to call social justice attitudes, the most obvious one being a prioritizing of group identity issues, matters of representation being foregrounded, particularly a focus on immutable aspects such as race, gender, and nationality, as well as an orientation generally drawing attention to foul play in the strata like racism, sexism, or bigotry. Studies show that there's been a recent spike in mentions of such identitarian phraseology. The word racist is used way more in the media Overton window now. We broadly tend to value empowering the marginalized racist or admonishing bigotry in the mainstream. This is seen in the arts too. On a random day, I looked at the homepage of one of the major art magazines, Hyperallergic, and most of the article headlines shoot through these sorts of issues, buzzwords, or identitarian metrics in general. Here's a few excerpts from an article from another major art publication, Freeze. These are their recommendations for great shows to see during Freeze New York 2025. Look at my highlighting for what sorts of terms and themes come up in their justifying inclusion. Every single exhibition that they recommended was done on the basis of empowering a supposedly underrepresented group or vaguely anti-oppressive or anti-hegemony theme, be it against capitalism or the white cis heteronormative. No mention of the art being good autonomously or beautiful in themselves. But this isn't all there is to a social justice attitude. Let's look at the Witten passage. There's disrepute brought to the forms an artwork could take, the material hierarchy of conventional painting, that this has to be deconstructed as though it were in vain as a racial or gendered hierarchy. This may sound innocuous, but classical art standards like beauty or realism are aligned with hegemonic groups according to social justice upholders. Realism, for instance, is often attributed to the oppressive European patriarchy's tastemaking thrust upon unfairly, that other less European standards should be elevated. We'll discuss this at further length in part 2, but this is a viewpoint that has dominated the higher art world for a long time and certainly doesn't need additional inclusion. It dates as far back as Clement Greenberg's writings on kitsch and representational art in 1939. By the 60s and 70s, conceptual art was the dominant form. The forms of art are assessed to being semiotically oppressive based on what they are associated with. This is seen not just in European realism and beauty and fine art, but in all cultural production. Examples include, but are not limited to, American linearity and Hollywood realism in film, masculine linear setup punchline structures in humor and joke telling, and the Judeo-Christian capitalistic hero's journey in narrative more broadly. Extending into even musicology, here influential critical theorist Fyodor Adorno likens the conductor of Anglo-European classical music to being like a Nazi. Not for nothing does the conductor remind one of the totalitarian Führer. Besides being luridly patronizing to minorities who often do enjoy the same art styles, purer than politics, we're sending the wrong message by ostensibly making ugliness their art style just as they become better represented. Manchester Art Gallery being filled to the brim with beautiful portraits by white men, whilst the contemporary section being a swirl of iconoclastic abstraction by the minorities, is hard to swallow. To suggest classical art language is somehow aligned with whiteness is therefore to deny other groups their right to higher achievement. This effectively is the pointy heads form of equally silly arguments that you hear in parlance, like the notions of math being racist or the idea that speaking articulately is speaking white. These broadly inclusive tendencies, whether through selecting out for minority group members or admonishing certain standards, are also predicated in equality of outcome politics, commonly known as equity. Equality of outcome is more a socialist politics, whilst in classically liberal politics, equality of opportunity policies are preferred so everyone has the same chance economically. But since outcomes are unequal still, there being more women in nursing and more men in STEM, the assumption from the unsociologically trained is that simply the system is unfair and we must tweak it until the end result is geometrically satisfying. Whilst this may seem a tempting proposition, it's ineffective and erroneously founded. First off, it discounts that groups choose to do different things with their opportunities, and one shouldn't want to force choices upon people for optics. We often neglect sociological tenets like the gender equality paradox, which derives from a Stoet and Geary study in 2018, demonstrating that when women are granted more opportunities, their career choices become more stereotypically gendered, such as going into nursing. Women who are STEM majors predominantly come from countries where there are less opportunities. This scales through consistently. Of course, the retort from here is predictably that women are socialized differently, taught to think they throw like a girl and such, deterred from certain positions. Thus, better representation is a must, so they grow up believing that they can indeed be what they desire. Representation is definitely worthy of discussion, but different choices often discarded as a factor. We can't pin every inconvenient example down to brainwashing. And if indeed there are equality of opportunity issues still, then equity doesn't fix the problem. It would be the equivalent of kicking a bucket under a leaking roof instead of patching the roof. This then broadly social constructionist mindset is the genesis of the uglifying of the arts, which here simply doesn't work because you can't force new tastes onto people inorganically. It also assumes that classical hierarchies emerged purely oppressively rather than organically as markers of competence, mere delegation, or mere taste. And when you tilt inorganically towards equity-based outcomes within competence, competence-based hierarchies, you end up with less competent workers who potentially do harm, lest letting the side down. This resulted in mass deaths in places like the Soviet Union or Venezuela, where they were attempted in agrarian and industrial practice. We often hear the word equity and just assume it's some cutesy, diabetic hands across America type of diversity. This is one of the foremost and unchallenged fallacies that political discussions are predicated on. Not everyone who challenges equity policies is a Trump-supporting Republican who detests seeing minorities existing. There's a very fair challenge posed against equity's longevity as a political practice. It being discussed at all should not make people this icked from the get-go. Besides this low-resolution interest in empowerment and vaguely anti-hegemonic iconoclasm, there's also the issue of who gets to speak on specific issues. We often hear about how stories from one group should be reserved for members belonging to that group. This derives from two critical theory concepts in Sandra Harding's standpoint epistemology and Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality. Standpoint theory assesses that if you're outside of a particular group, you have no way of genuinely speaking to their experiences accurately. We've seen the backlash an actor gets when they're cast as a character beyond their accorded remit. Scarlett Johansson was set to play a trans man in Rug and Tug and withdrew from the role after criticism. These are discourses having a regular impact on design choices and culture production then. A notorious case in art is the Dana Schutz scandal in 2016. Dana Schutz is an American figurative painter who painted this image of Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old boy who was lynched by two white men in Mississippi in 1955. She did this out of solidarity, having seen a lot of black men being shot by the police on the news at the time. This yielded emotive protests on how she'd overstepped and profited off another group's trauma tastelessly. Protests demanded not only the artwork's removal from the gallery space, but its destruction and the termination of her entire art career, even though her intentions were empathetic. These are cases of standpoint theory being invoked, but they also rely on intersectionality, now a tactical buzzword. Intersectionality considers how identities like race, gender, class, sexual orientation, and disability interact. The example given by its originator is in a black woman suffering from forms of oppression that are unique to their being both a black person and a woman, rather than just issues that a black person or a woman would suffer from separately. This proves to be useful in law, as these intersected issues certainly can arise and need accounting for when they do, so to legally judge the scale of guilt and harm properly. However, what it has evolved into is this rigid list for measuring who has more oppression and thus, when combined with standpoint theory, who gets to speak more on political issues, how people are going to be represented, and who gets to make what jokes on who. This is problematic for several reasons, namely the denial of human empathy and universal emotions that we can all relate to each other on. I don't know what it's like to be black in America, but I do know what it's like to be a mother, says Dana Schutz. I'm not particularly fond of her painting, but the idea that only an in-group member is capable of speaking to an in-group's experience is just untrue. Football pundits that are ex-footballers are awful pundits oftentimes. Good with the feet doesn't mean good with the brain or the mouth. Valuable ethnographic research and contributions come frequently from an out-group member, often precisely because they're outsiders and can see the forest from the trees. I'm by no means saying that you should aim to step beyond your remit with every word or art piece, but the Barnum statements about how you should stifle yourself and know your place are spurious. The intersectional ladder draws an essentialist caste system that disregards individual exceptions. It denies the individual status of people in minority groups and relegates them to enlightened stereotypes. And, in our fear of offense, art becomes the sterile prompt from which to implicitly adhere to without proof. There's the SCAD capstone animated film that I saw called Piece of Cake, where the moral ordering of characters from good to evil fits perfectly within this desired groove. White man bad, brown man better, white girl even better, and brown girl best. Oh, and the white girl gets their arm broken off and thus becomes disabled, therefore raised up the moral ranking. I was astounded to see such unabashed narrative affirmation. It was all right to a T. And due to the infinitely fractionating identity markers aligned with oppression, one can demand someone more marginalized to be represented in your place ad infinitum. Extreme cases would be the feminist group called Pink being asked to make space for black women, and Michelle Obama being asked to make space for black trans disabled women. You can perpetually compare someone hypothetically with someone less privileged. There's always a way in which one voice isn't the right voice for the story, but it's a bogus imposition to assume one voice can ever totally be right as well. Spike Lee, known for his films exploring racial dynamics, makes this claim when asked if he could make a film about the Asian American experience or if someone else could make a movie about the black American experience. He says that art is about human commonality. He makes the germane analogy that if he were to make a film about the black American jazz players from the 1920s, he'd have to dive his head into researching the 20s, jazz, and being being a black person then, even being black now, there's a gap to be bridged as an individual. He says that he can't just be expected to get it, as such questions presuppose. That would be a radical racial reductionism. So whilst intersectionality can be helpful, its use for infinite fractionation and caste rankings yields new problems and reinscribes old ones. This problem of limitless ways of slicing a person into groups has already been resolved philosophically by the Judeo-Christian and Aristotelian principles that the West is founded on, that at the very bottom of these separations is the sovereign individual and their potential for uniqueness. It is in respecting people's potential for personhood that there was a push towards abolishing slavery or granting women the right to vote. Of course, people have and still discriminate on prejudicial grounds, so the line has to start somewhere, but we mustn't throw the baby out of the bathwater. Under this caste-style system, you can effectively pit anyone against anyone for aligning something higher rung versus something lower rung. Damon Young's straight black men are the white people of black people being one of the more ridiculous headlines. It also isn't uncommon to hear trans men on the front foot considered unprivileged for being trans, ascending into needing to recognize their male privilege even shortly after transition. Thus, there's a general obsequiousness and servility that has brewed into the arts and culture. We are terrified of causing offense. American Dirt, a story of migrants journeying through Mexico towards the American border, is written by Janine Cummins, an author of mixed Irish and Puerto Rican descent, but passes as white. Despite doing copious amounts of research, Cummins was so concerned about being unqualified to write the book that she expressed this fear in a guilt-ridden author's note. "I wished someone browner than me would write it," she laments. A positive review of the book for New York Times grovels that, "I was sure I was the wrong person to review this book. I have never been Mexican or a migrant." We fear offense so much that we preempt it through such groveling, and in many cases, offense is enough to lose you your job. Gary Garrows was the curator of painting and sculpture at the San Francisco Museum of Art. After a presentation about the acquisition of works by artists of color, Garrows joked that, "Don't worry, we'll definitely still continue to collect white artists." When pressed on how inappropriate this was by a journalist, he made the clunky claim that reverse racism shouldn't be the answer for resolving racism. This brought accusations of toxic white supremacist beliefs, and he ended up resigning in severe apology. Instead of a culture of learning on the job, amending knowledge gaps as part of your routine, our fear of offense has transmuted into outright lack of forgiveness, even for oneself. Nobody is perfect, and instead of acknowledging that and improving with new information, you get groveling, wet wipey writing like this art critic's, admitting that they're not equipped to critically assess the show, for missing out on an artist playing with gender tropes, or omitting an artist from a gallery who turned out to be a woman later on. This fear is most pronounced in the decline of straight-up comedies in cinemas. Think to the 2000s when there were tons in cinemas. They now draw way less revenue and are too financially and critically risky for studios, the exception being the Eat the Rich satires, what Bong Joon-ho calls the upstairs downstairs movie, as their theme and humor compel only punching up. The intrusion of obsequiousness into realms of humor is easily the most damaging blow to human beings in my view. It makes us all dumber and more fragile. Studies show that enjoyment of humor, particularly darker forms of humor, are linked with higher intelligence. The fear of offense fundamentally misplaces understanding of what humor is. In studies on racial jokes in Racist Acts and Racist Humor by Michael Phillips, in the jokes that are racially toned, like Polish jokes, it is not necessary to have racist beliefs or attitudes towards Polish people. They are more often fantasies enjoyed for its clever depiction of stupidity. Sometimes, the joke is funny precisely because it is implicit that we think that the bad thing is bad, like dead baby jokes. A shocking amount of people are ill-equipped to understand the context. They operate on Voldemort He Who Mustn't Be Named logic, whereby mentioning the bad thing equates to the bad thing being involved. Like joking about dead babies means that babies should die. Connor Kianpur coined the phrase comic immoralism, the belief that immorality enhances funniness by widening the incongruity. Like how removing the Polish element of the joke makes it less funny. Our finding it funny could be precisely because we have a shared respect of what is wrong and actually speaks to an implicit guile with boundaries. You see this in how working class cultures receive such jokes and grace, unlike the trust fund bourgeoisie. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt has spoken extensively about how our culture teaches people to learn helplessness with the adopting of what is effectively an inverted form of cognitive behavioral therapy. Instead of attempts at perceiving stimuli or stressors as positively as possible in order to act in the world, we tell children that words hurt them and that they're justified in allowing their emotions to derail their bodily functions. This runs analogously with arguments that art and media depictions are harmful. It is particularly regressive for human beings and against animal nature. Ethologists like Jack Panksepp have drawn parallels between human uses of humor and animal play activities that develop the brain. Think of how young animals play mock aggressively to develop their bodies, lion cubs pretending to hunt, and they do so in exaggerated ways to get their bearings. Young monkeys leap not just from branch to branch, but from trees into rivers. In doing so, they learn to cope with unexpected situations, like being chased by a new kind of predator. We as human beings do this too, but we also do it mentally as thinking creatures, by risking offense. By taking away this leeway, we stunt growth and atrophy our minds. By taking away that which offends, we don't offend people less, we merely raise their sensitivity to what is offensive. Of course, comic immoralism aside, there are some who laugh precisely because they are in agreement with the thing that is wrong. You get actual racists who watch South Park totally myopic to the point. But we still have to teach people that it just isn't the worst thing in the world to be on the end of a joke. That's the real utilitarian cost of living in a free speech society. For you to have access to your best self, others have access to their worst. The cost of losing our capacity to think is far worse than offense, on the other hand. As you look to the drop in IQ, rise in social ineptitude, and cluster B personality obsessions with how the looking glass self is perceived. Instead of using our words and besting bad arguments symbolically, the politicizing tendency on every metric of art and discourse makes every move a potential stressor with the social justice frameworks. The autonomy that art aimed for at various points throughout history, say in the Romantic period where we sought the sublime devoid of ideology, is now regarded as naivete. Novelist Toni Morrison says not only that all art is political, but that to say you are not political is to take a political stance siding with the status quo. That's what an artist is, a politician. This is an axiom taken to be a given in art discussions. Look at the Janssen's History of Art textbook, one of the two major art history textbooks, the other being Gardner's Art Through the Ages. Janssen's last chapter on European postmodernist art showcases this progressive move towards politics. Now scholars approached art from countless angles, using issues of gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, race, economics, and politics to demonstrate the many layers of meaning and ideas embedded in a work of art. Professor of Art History Keith Moxey adds succinctly, "All cultural practice is shaped by political considerations." Besides this attitude being taken as a given, our discursive movements shall be predicated on how politically beneficial they are to our bias. The abandonment of an epistemological foundation for art history means that historical arguments will be evaluated according to how well they coincide with our political convictions and cultural attitudes. So this is a commandment on confronting art purely in terms of their politics. Whilst a Republican is in charge, these attitudes are endemic and won't be eradicated anytime soon. Certainly at private businesses like universities responsible for providing credibility to these ideas. Reading for politics is entrenched in the raison d'etre of our classrooms. Most of the liberal arts classes I've sat through here have boiled down to a game of spot the racist instead of deeper understanding of the text we read. I remember this student's outrageous essay on how Shirley Jackson's The Lottery was about the importance of social justice issues. She plugged it into the only thing she could understand. Whilst much great art is political, Picasso's Guernica, not all great art is political, nor are great political artworks great because they were political. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is a wonderful story, not for its Christian overtones, but for its allegorical finesse and universally relatable theme of self-improvement. Whilst everything can be politically toned, not everything is purely political. To orient art purely towards politics often comes at the cost of developing art language and art skills, which is a Faustian bargain because if the politics were genuinely that pressing, you'd think it'd be best to learn how to articulate it better. But making art about politics in place of being incapable of difficult art skills has a long-standing history. Bad artists have consistently become iconoclasts. In one of the most significant social psychology books, The True Believer, Thoughts on the Nature of Mass Movements, Eric Hoffer traces the correlation between failing artists and authoritarian political extremism. Hitler is, of course, the famous example. In lieu of artistic success, one can at least cope by saying their art speaks to something important, or they blame the foundations of society for not gratifying their higher Maslowian desires. It is understandable that those who fail should incline to blame the world for their failure. The failed artist is more likely to be a fanatic. And not only that, the world has to be deemed unfair or it would mean that they are totally responsible for their own failures. Artworks then aim to purely denounce rather than glorify or celebrate an amor fati. Hoffer writes, "Freedom aggravates as much as it alleviates frustration. Freedom of choice places the whole blame of failure on the shoulders of the individual. The need for racism outstrips its supply then. This is a massive reason why the weak-minded have to materialize the agreement that we all believe that prejudice Paris is evil in every room they walk into. That's the only card that some can play. If realism was hard to train for, then it must be that it's the bourgeois style. My art isn't bad, it is merely my style. This is what Nietzsche called slave morality. People who are stronger than you must also be evil. If we cannot attain our desires, we cope by transmuting values by saying that weakness is a virtue, also known in the kids' lingo as copium. Beauty exposes ugliness, so we desecrate it to avoid its judgment. To avoid moral judgment, there's political movement and front foot guilt tripping. These unsuccessfully challenged politics have gained cultural capital, making them seductive weapons of choice. A toxically sentimental misconception here is that being on the side of social justice automatically makes you a better person. Crying more often about something doesn't mean you care more, and taking offense doesn't mean you're right. Oftentimes, it is mere emotional blackmail. Being the one to bring up racial issues doesn't automatically mean you understand them better. We live in a post-truth time where it's as tempting as ever for young people to fetishize a social justice issue for identity actualization. The internet happened, any bias can be confirmed. One can Google search their headcanon into being and find groups that conform to existing beliefs. Freezing ourselves at the egocentric pre-listening stage of adolescent development, we're very much living in what Jameson called the postmodern condition. Our primordial circuit desires an identity and place in a community that now feels more insurmountable than ever with the scarring of cultural stalwarts of old. Religion, the nation-state, even the arts. Such existential dread can be soothed by camping perpetually on the safe side of the Cartman drama triangle. Victim and or savior, but never the perpetrator. And this requires an enemy. Reifying evil to be elevated to good takes less effort than being good. Like the legend Saint George, swinging at air having slayed the dragon and falling in love with the fetishized accolades. Why else are so many social justice zealots not just right on one issue, but on many? Why is it that they post about LGBTQ plus issues after having been proven right on, say, how objectively awful the Gaza situation is? It is akin to a Dostoevskian underground man living inside their head drama, the poor Eternus Jungian archetype, a forever child who never grows up, or the artist without any art. Where once harsh reality compelled growth and your voluntary responsibility yielded true identity actualization through mastery of the game, we can keep supplying our headcanon endlessly and skip to the end where we are the solidified hero. The immediate praise of hero status from ascent, supported by equal reification from enemy dissent, both misnomers. Mark Twain's short story War Prayer puts this denial of the Big Other aptly. In times of war, we propagandize the other side to being monsters, because if they weren't, what does that make us? Looking inward for the monsters is terrifying, but that is the essence of truly growing up and the first step to heroism. I'm by no means saying that everyone who subscribes by these views is a narcissist, but it does seem that these attitudes, in closing off the Big Other hermetically, reducing the other side to something easier to contest, leaves ample legroom for ego projection. Hegel's Enttäuschung. The game now selects out for covert narcissism traits and incentivizes bad acting, unless we're allowed to ask for the working out. The studies measuring an increase in social justice beliefs in the West have coincided with studies measuring the West's spike in narcissistic personality inventory traits. There are even studies showing a particular spike in MPI traits on college campuses. Further, that whilst high MPI once correlated with higher dropout rates and lower grades, now narcissistic students get better grades from narcissistic professors. It is at least worth considering next time we find ourselves held morally hostage. The retort then, of course, would be, why should one look inward when indeed there are racists about? If I am indeed below on the intersectional ladder to the hegemony, none of my bad faith can ever amount to being as bad as prolonged systemic racism or the evils of the historically oppressive. Reverse racism, if it exists, will never be as bad as racism. It's still better to be a footless fetishizer on the left than on the right. To that I say, two wrongs don't make a right even if they're not the same level of wrong, and there being worse evil to exist does not mean that your acts are not a reflection of you. It's cosmically arrogant to assume your foible doesn't make you a bad person. There's no golden ticket to foible for anyone. Principles going out the window means that new grievances will be created the day it overcorrects, and it arguably already has in the respects that reparations can never make slavery right by punishing people who have never owned slaves for people who have never been slaves. No victim of 2025 has it worse than most perpetrators of 1925. With the wrong principles, we can only make present matters worse. Too conveniently. Whether things overcorrect can never truly be measured. People can just act terribly whilst bluffing that if the shoe was on the other foot, they would not have been tyrannical like the oppressors historically. closely. What I know as someone whose family escaped communist China and personally lived through Hong Kong's fall to authoritarianism by their hands is to trust sweet shop owners at one's peril. Often, when the working out looks wrong, we end up with even worse tyrants when the shoe is on the other foot. Barbarism starts at home, and reducing the other side to a bogeyman whilst postulating sanctimoniously has historical precedents for political failure and increasing extremism. Sociologist Stanley Cohen in Folk Devils and Moral Panics showed that news coverage branding mods and rockers as delinquents actually amplified delinquent behavior and increased their numbers as outsiders sought the labeling as identity. Hillary Clinton had the basket of deplorables line, which lost her crucial fence sitters. It's largely agreed to be her great error in political studies, and yet we repeated the same trick last election. So thoughtlessness on either side cannot go unchallenged, arguably especially your side. This was a long rant to conclude part one, but it's such a tacitly unchallenged presumption of moral sanctity that I felt it deserved logical assassination. To go back to art then, art's mandate was once to help expand our minds, act as a corrective to said thoughtlessness, to help us live outside our heads. They now pornographically fortify the furniture within, which in turn corrupts the external in a feedback loop, and it doesn't work for anyone's cause.